recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Hey everybody, it's been a while. We had a little bit of a break unexpectedly the last couple of weeks, and thanks for everybody who reached out. Some people posted on my Facebook asking, you know, where what happened, where are you? And unfortunately, my stepdad passed away a couple of weeks ago, and so I had to go home for 10 days. And the good news is I do have an episode. And I didn't have to do very much work for it because of the fact that I have a wonderful friend. Her name is Sarah Slinker, and that's who you're going to hear from today. And she was able to record it with me. Luckily, it was before my stepdad passed away, so I've been holding on to it, and it's ready for you guys today. Wherever you're listening, you know, whoever you are, or, you know, whatever you're doing with your family, and or you're out and about and doing stuff in the car or whatever, just stop and think about people you love, and if you need to reach out and talk to them and say that you love them, because you never know when something can just be taken away, especially a loved one. It was super unexpected, and my stepdad went up to take a nap, and he never woke up, so it can be that quick. And then there's the other side of the coin, as always. You know, there's people out there who are suffering every day with someone who's losing their life to cancer or some other horrible disease. So, you know, it's just a matter of, we all got our time. It's just a matter of when. But anyway, I just wanted to let everybody out there know what's been going on the last couple of weeks. And I'm happy to be on track. We got some really big news. And I don't know if you've all heard about this, but I hope if you're a true crime person like we are, you know, you would have heard about this. John Dillinger's family members are asking for an exhumation of his body. They're going to exhume John Dillinger's body. Now, the myth and folklore around all this, you know, especially with the fact that Dillinger's family was offered money in the early after his death, like right after his death, to have his body on display and brought around like a circus. You know, they were freaked out about that. John Dillinger's dad decided, you know what, let's encase him in concrete and some steel so no one can dig and grave rob and take John's body. So that's one of the first interesting things about this John Dillinger body exhumation. And the other thing was that could be not him. It could be a different person. It could be really interesting. I mean, it could be empty. Who knows? You know, somebody else brought this up to my attention when I was talking about him. Like, it was almost like, it's almost like going into Al Capone's grave. Or, not grave. He goes into Al Capone's vault, and there's just a couple of beer bottles. It's like, it could be something like that. But this is different. This is a grave. This is not, you know, the closest that we've come to this, folks, is the H.H. Holmes episode with the great-great-grandson of H.H. Holmes. They exhumed his body in Philadelphia. And the DNA... well, who knows? We don't know. We don't know about that. You heard Jeff talk about it on the podcast. So anyway, big interesting stuff. I got to tell you, this is what I'm doing in the front of the episode, that I absolutely have a great couple of episodes that I'm lined up and ready to go for this Dillinger. The exhumation's happening on September 16th. I'm working on getting some monster interviews. Like, big time, guys. And I can't wait to bring it to you. And I'm also, it's not going to be just one person. We got different angles. because now it's like I'm in the epicenter of this news story. I mean, like, I've known, you know, obviously we've all known about Dillinger, but like everybody talks about Dillinger here in Indianapolis. So there's always a store that was robbed by him out in, you know, there's one in Irvington. There's one down the street and on Mass Avenue, the bank there, the Art Bank. You know, it's crazy. All these different places. And there's still, you know, obviously folklore around who he was. He was kind of like the Robin Hood of his time, you know. He got put away really early. And then later on, came out of prison, basically went to college in prison and learned how to be a criminal and a gangster. And then he wanted to get his revenge. So he went and robbed the banks. So it's crazy. Anyway, we're going to get into all of that in the upcoming weeks. But I want to get us back here to this podcast that's coming up. Sarah Slinker, again, a friend of mine. If you liked the Misty Wallace episode, you're going to love this episode. Misty Wallace and Sarah are friends. They work. Misty has worked with Sarah to get her to do the similar things where she goes into a jail. Sarah will go over what it was like to be in jail, in prison, talking to these people about her story. And her story is incredible. Sarah is a domestic violence survivor. And you'll hear her story and about the night that changed her life forever. But also a deeper look into her journey of healing as well. So again, if you like Misty Wallace and that episode, you're going to freaking love this one. And I got to say it. I'm so excited, everybody. Carrie Melillo, my wife, is on the episode. I felt it was very necessary for me to get a woman's perspective in with me, so I wasn't just hitting it from a male perspective. It would have been just irresponsible of me if I didn't do it that way. So I asked my wife to sit in with me on it, and she does great. You know, I really think my wife is just the coolest person, and I'm so excited to bring her on something that I care about deeply. And obviously, she's helped me with from day one. I mean, we wouldn't be doing interviews if it wasn't for Carrie. So I'm so excited to finally be able to bring her on into something that she's passionate about. You know, we want to help people in our life. We're looking into different ways and how we all can do it. And this is one of them, by getting the information out to people as fast as possible and as easily as a podcast is able to get to people's ears. I mean, this is a great microphone in a lot of different ways. Guys, we've hit 17,000 listens. I mean, it's like insane. And then we hit, I think, the other day, I went to Strassenfest down in southern Indiana. And Strassenfest in Jasper, Indiana, if anybody doesn't know what it is, you guys got to go. It's a German fest in the middle of southern Indiana, and it was hilarious. And we met some of Carrie's friends. So I had a bunch of fun. We had a great time. Brats, beer, German chocolate pecan pie, and some elephant ears, of course. I mean, fair atmosphere. It was great music all night, polkaing. We saw a lot of Carrie's friends and family. It was wonderful. If you don't know what Strassenfest is, it's amazing. It's one of the coolest places. It was my first time ever going. Everybody has always gone. I've never been because, you know, I'm not from Indiana, so I didn't get to go for the last couple of years. I've known Carrie. There's been Gen Con. So, listen, everybody, I'm getting off track. Thanks for listening. There's a lot of updates, so that's why this intro is a little longer, but we have some big things coming up in the next couple of weeks. And when it comes to updates, I'll make sure you guys get those updates either on Instagram or Facebook if maybe an episode's going to come out a little bit earlier than expected. This Dillinger thing is huge, and I'm going to be all over it, so we'll try to get you some monster podcast stuff that you guys would really find interesting. I got to call my boy Al Hunter, make sure he understands. He was already on the news doing interviews on the news about the Dillinger body exhumation. So we're gonna see. We're gonna follow this along and see what comes out of it. So this episode, though, enjoy it. It's Sarah Slinker, Carrie Melillo, and myself in our living room, just kind of sitting around a table in our kitchen and sitting around a table and listening to Sarah's story, and it is amazing. So please enjoy. Thanks very much. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm Joe Melillo, your host. And with me today, I have two guests. We've been having male
guests on this infamous indie show, but we are flipping the script today, and we have two female guests. One is my wife, Carrie Melillo. Hello, Carrie.
Hey, guys.
And the other is Sarah Slinker, and she is a domestic abuse violence victim survivor. I'm going to let her tell her story because this all happened in Indianapolis.
Yes, it did.
Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thanks, Joe.
We were connected by our other friend, Misty Wallace, who you've heard on this podcast before.
Yes, I have.
She is this incredible person who just connects everyone and ultimately is doing so good. If you haven't heard the podcast, go back and listen to it because it's amazing and she's incredible. And then ultimately, what do you call him, Chap?
Chap, yes. Keith Chaplin, the black. Yeah, he's the chaplain from Indiana Department of Correction. He was Misty's offender.
Amazing. And yes. Now they're friends.
Oh, yes.
I called her yesterday, and sure enough, she was on vacation, and I said, is Keith there? And she goes, no, but he was hanging out with us last weekend during July 4th.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So. It's not uncommon for them to spend holidays together.
Amazing. So today I decided to ask Carrie to join us, Sarah, because I'm not stupid in the sense that I'm a male, and this might be different from my perspective than maybe Carrie has questions that might bring up other things that I wouldn't be able to. So, Carrie, are you okay with this? Are you?
She's. I guess.
She's got her dog
in now.
she's got her dog, so hopefully she'll be okay with it with our little dog hero here. Let's go right into your story. I'd like you to start from day one of where you think your story began in this realm.
Okay. As far as this case goes and how I got involved with Bridges to Life, I went through a pretty nasty divorce in 2008 after 25 years of marriage, a very, very dysfunctional marriage. And I got into a relationship with a man, first just through telephone and letters, who was in prison. A young man who had grown up with my two sons was actually in the same facility with this man. And this young man's comment to me was, you know, he's an old guy like you, Sarah. He's not a young dude like me, and he just wants to get to know you. So I got to writing letters with a man by the name of Todd Brinson. And then that proceeded to phone calls. And this all started in 2009, early part of 2010.
So you were connected through the prison by another prisoner?
Yes.
With
who was housed with this man.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And this.
And how did you know the other prisoner?
The other prisoner was a young man who had grown up with my two sons, who had made some poor choices in life. And he was determined to turn his life around. So at this point, I was visiting him on a regular basis, being a source of encouragement to him that you can change when you can get out. You can do better things. And that's when he introduced me to Todd Brinson. And Todd and I first started corresponding through letters. Then I would put money on an account where he would call me on the phone 3 times a week. We'd get 20-minute conversations. We got to know each other through letters and those phone calls. I poured out my heart and soul to him about what I'd been through in my 25 years of my marriage, which was not an easy thing to talk about. And this man just really embraced me and made me feel like I was the princess I felt I truly deserved to be. Mm. And the first time we met was inside the chapel at what was the Indiana Reentry Facility on the east side of Indianapolis, was at one time the women's prison. And we met inside that chapel for the first time on April 21st of 2010. The young man that I had introduced the two of us, he was graduating from a college class where IUPUI brought students in. And this class was graduating, so I went to the graduation. That was the first time Todd and I met face-to-face. At that point, it had been letters and phone calls.
What was that moment like?
It was. I felt as though God was pointing me in this direction, because after all, I was in the Lord's house. I was inside a chapel. Yeah, I was inside of a prison, but you know, these guys had made mistakes, and that was my attitude towards this man. This young man who I had been visiting on a regular basis had made a mistake. We all make mistakes. I just wanted to get to know people, you know, to get let them know they could make differences. And meeting him for the first time there was amazing and exciting. And then he was released just a few months later in September of 2010.
Wow. So very quickly.
Yes.
Things went from letters. Well, that was a pretty long time. Mm-hmm. And then
phone calls.
And then
he was released from prison.
It sounds like a regular courtship. Like you would
yes.
date somebody.
You'd
start
pretty
out
much,
slow.
You get
and
to
then,
know each other.
Yeah.
You know, we got to know each other through letters and phone calls.
So that moment in the chapel, you felt very strongly that this was supposed to be
a relationship mm-hmm. of some sort. I wasn't sure what. Mm-hmm. And then when he was released, it was an immediate relationship. You know, the very next day, how they work it in the Department of Corrections, when you're released, you are typically released at 12:01 a.m. Yes, just 1 minute after midnight. That is how DOC does things. So you got to have family members there available to pick you up at 12:01 a.m. His sister and his father picked him up. He spent the first night free at his sister's house. The next night he spent at my apartment and pretty much every night after that.
When you guys started your relationship, how typical was it? Was it something that he was still struggling with being in prison and now he's out?
No, he seemed to handle that fairly well. The biggest difficulty for him was employment. I did find out from being involved with an ex-felon, it is very difficult for them to find somebody to hire them. You know, he would apply for job after job as soon as he would check the box. Yes, I have been a convicted felon. 9 times out of 10, never got a phone call. So that was a struggle.
What was he convicted of?
He had been convicted of aggravated battery. And he took me down to the state house. And we got somewhere in that building, we got some sort of a certified copy of what he was convicted of, because some job he had applied for required that he have that certified document that came from the state.
Was that the first time that he ever mentioned or you knew for certain what he was convicted of?
No. We had discussed during the time we had talked on the phone and during our letters back and forth that he told me he was in prison because his wife's uncle was giving his wife methamphetamine. And he did not want his wife on drugs, and that the uncle would not stop doing it. And he told me he beat the uncle up. Aggravated battery. That's aggravated battery.
Makes sense.
It made perfect sense to me.
When you guys are out of prison and you're now dating, he's living with you.
Mm-hmm.
You're the only ones that's supporting him.
Yes.
Because we know the end of the story, we've talked about it, but tell my listeners, at what point were there red flags looking back? Now 2020.
Oh yeah.
But that then you wouldn't have known, and maybe you skipped over some of these red flags to say, you know what, this guy, he's treating me like a princess.
Yes. You know, there was the initial, he didn't want me out of his sight. He loved me so much, and that was a nice feeling.
Comforting.
Even comforting was true. After a nasty divorce, after 25 years of marriage in a very bad marriage, it was so nice to have somebody who just couldn't get enough of me. And that's the way I viewed it. He just was in awe of me and just wanted to be with me. I couldn't go to the grocery store alone. That's not a woman's job. Oh my gosh, in the 25 years I was married, I can't tell you. I always did the grocery shopping alone. This man would get within 5 cents of what our total was when we got to the checkout. He knew exactly how much we were spending. Because let's face it, I was the only one working.
So that was good for you as well. You like that?
Yes.
I mean, he's taking your money into account and saying, we need to stay to a budget.
Yes, we do. He applied for
budgets are hard.
Yes, they are.
As my wife laughs. You know... what was maybe one of the first incidents that you guys were, because it sounds like everything was going pretty well, and I'm sure you're telling your family, hey, this guy's, he's probably met your family.
Oh, yeah. My family loved him. My grandkids spent weekends with us. Uh-huh. My oldest grandson, love him to death. He is on the autism spectrum. He is ADHD, and he's hearing impaired. So Shane is a handful, and Shane doesn't relate to a whole lot of people, but he and Todd clicked, and that was something that was important to me, was that somebody that my grandkids felt comfortable with, and they did. But then there were the signs that started happening, the things that made me kind of, maybe this isn't exactly the fairy tale romance that I really thought it was. Like a broken laptop that happened while I was at work. But you know, Todd's over 6 foot tall and he weighs close to 300 pounds. And I could understand him tripping over the ottoman and the phone, the cords for the laptop. I can understand him landing on top of that and that breaking that laptop. And I could understand the time that he said his cell phone was in his back pocket and one of the cats ran in front of him and he slipped on the kitchen floor because he had just mopped it and the cell phone broke. But then there was that night at 2-3 o'clock in the morning that I woke up to the sound of one of our cats screaming, and we had gotten these two kittens from his sister, Jimmy Jam Hendrix and Janice Joe Joplin. And they were our babies. But we slept with the bedroom door closed because kittens like to, at 3 o'clock in the morning, go running across your face. And I was sound asleep, but I could hear the cats screaming. And it wasn't them fighting, playing, screaming. It was, I'm hurt, somebody save me, screaming. Mm-hmm. And I realized I was alone in bed. Todd was not there with me. And as I opened the bedroom door, I could see Todd with all of his weight pushing against our steel front door. And I could see the cat's tail sticking out. And each time he pushed against the door, the cat screamed that god-awful noise. And I screamed, what are you doing? And he jumped. And the cat came out from between the screen door and the steel door and ran. Because it was in pain. That was one of the biggest red flags. But he assured me that he just didn't understand that the cat was there. I said, how did you not hear the cat? He had excuses for everything. He could excuse away anything.
I feel like sometimes when you're in a relationship and it's so good and these things happen, you believe that because you want to believe the best in that person.
You do.
And it's hard to imagine when you're not that way that somebody could actually do something hurtful.
Yes. And the fact that his family continually thanked me because he went to probation meetings once a month. And those were in downtown Franklin, Johnson County, because he refused to have his probation out of Marion County because he said he knew he would fail. That's what he told his dad. So he had his dad rent him an apartment in Johnson County. So his dad paid the rent. His dad paid the utilities. And his dad gave him spending money because he couldn't get a job. But that was all to make probation happy. But each month when we met with probation, my parents lived right down the street from the courthouse. So every month we would go and spend time with my parents. My parents loved this man. He opened car doors for me. He opened the door for me. That was something they never saw me get. They never saw me get that loving treatment in my 25 years of marriage. And they saw it with this man in that short time. A lot of people saw it. He went to church with me every Sunday. Every morning we woke up and we read scripture together. He was the biggest con artist that was there. But he had my heart, and I believed that he had changed. But the truth was, he never changed at all. And that was proven to me on the night of September 21st of 2011. He'd been out of prison for 1 year and 3 days. We had just celebrated on September 18th up at TGI Fridays at Castleton Square Mall with his dad, his stepmom, his two sisters, and their families, and my two granddaughters, that Todd had been out of prison for a year. It was also his dad's 73rd birthday. And the whole family was so grateful to me on how well Todd had done. No problems with probation. No failed appointments, no failed urine tests, no nothing. They were proud. And 3 days later, Todd got off work, and he went to Kroger to rent us a Redbox movie, and he brought me some of my favorite Roslyn Zebra brownies. Oh, I was so happy when Kroger brought those recipes back. And we watched a movie like we did most nights when he got off work. And he drank an awful lot of fruit juice and tomato juice that night. But he drank a lot of liquids in the evenings to replenish because Todd at that time had found a job. He worked out at University Loft out off of Mount Comfort and 70, loading and unloading 53-foot semi-trailers.
Wow.
In the heat of the summer.
And big guy like that.
And a big guy like that sweats a lot.
Yeah.
Loading and unloading semis. So it wasn't unusual for him to consume large quantities of liquids. I mean, he would pack his lunch every day and he would take 4 Gatorades and 4 waters. And that was to get him through a 10-hour shift. Mm. And he would drink every bit of that. So that part didn't surprise me. But at the end of the movie, Todd's dad called him. And I could tell Todd was getting agitated, which that wasn't uncommon. Because Jack Brinson liked to control Todd in every aspect of his life. And Todd didn't like that. And he handed the phone to me and said, "Here, Dad wants to talk to you." And his dad said, "I think Todd might be having a stroke. It sounds like he has slurred speech." I said, "I haven't noticed. We just finished watching this movie." And he said, "Has he taken his blood pressure medicine every morning?" Todd's dad is a pharmacist, so medication isn't an issue. Daddy can get him whatever he needs. I said, "Yeah, Jack, he takes that pill every morning before he goes to work. He complains he doesn't like to take it because of the way it makes him feel, but I watch him take it. Well, Sarah, I'm concerned. If you notice anything strange tonight, call me. I promise you, Jack, I will." So it was time to go to bed. I already had my nightshirt on. And my nightly routine was to go get a glass of chocolate milk to take my nighttime meds. At this point, I was having some bad migraines and I was on medication that knocked me on my butt so that it helped. When I opened the refrigerator, there was an empty fifth of vodka in the refrigerator. Remember, Todd's on probation and he's not supposed to be drinking. And I had been scheduled for a biopsy that day, which Todd made me cancel because he didn't want to go to the free clinic and sit there with me with all of those bums, as he called them. So I canceled my biopsy appointment, but I had 4 750-milligram hydrocodones for that appointment to take to prepare me for that biopsy procedure. Those were also gone. Those had been on the kitchen counter.
Was that typical for him to drink?
Not that I was aware of.
Okay.
Not that I was aware of, but evidently he had been drinking a lot when I was not aware of it.
Behind your back, yes. Hiding it.
Yes, yeah. So I looked at him and I said, "What is this bottle of vodka? I had a rough day today. Where's my medicine for my biopsy? I took those pills, my knee was bothering me." I said, "So you're intoxicated. And you know that's against the rules of your probation. I don't care." I said, "So that's why you're talking the way you're talking. That's why your dad was so concerned. He thought you were having a stroke, but you're just lit." And I said, "And you know how I feel about this. I explained it to you in my letters, that I was married to a man who drank every day. I couldn't live with another man who drank. And you drank. And I said, you need to leave. You need to go to your apartment in Greenwood." "No, I'm not leaving. I'll get pulled over and I'll get arrested." So at this point, I said, "Then I'm fine. I'm not staying here." So I have my nightgown on. So I went into my bedroom. And at this point, in September of 2011, I was unemployed, so I was taking care of my grandkids full time. So my thought was, I will just go to my son's house and spend the night, and I'll just be there in the morning with my grandkids, and everything will be fine. Well, I walked in that bedroom to put on a pair of sweatpants to leave, but I never even got one leg into those pants. Todd picked me up, and he threw me across the room. He knocked our queen-size bed off of its frame and up against the wall, and me up against the wall, and he pulls me out from against the wall, screaming and yelling at me. And then he gets on top of me and straddles me, and he begins punching me repeatedly, as hard as he can. Blow after blow to my face as I'm trying to defend myself, as I'm screaming bloody murder for him to stop hitting me, but he won't. And my cell phone rings, and it distracts him for just a moment. And at that point, I try to knee him in the groin, but that was not successful. But he did get up off of me, and I made a run for my front door. And I got to my front door. I got that steel door open, but he always locked that storm door, and I couldn't get it unlocked before he got to me. And he grabbed hold of me, and he slammed the steel door shut, and he flung me against the back wall of the apartment. And when I came to, he was standing over me, screaming at me, saying, "Look at the mess you've made. What are you doing?" And as I looked down, I saw my blood splattered all over the floor in front of me, and I saw my bloody handprint on our white door. I said, "I don't know what I'm doing." So I told him that I needed to check my cell phone because one of the granddaughters had been sick. And I said, it could be my son or daughter-in-law needing to check on the last time the baby had her medicine. So Todd allowed me to check my phone. It was not my son that had called. It was my next door neighbor. I'm sure he had heard my cries for help. And I told Todd, I just need to text the time that the baby had her medicine. That's it. So I texted the word help in capital letters to my next door neighbor, David.
Wow.
It was the only thing I could think to do.
You had to. You had to do that.
So at that point, Todd's still yelling at me about the mess that I've made. And so I say, I need to go in the bathroom then and start cleaning up. And of course, what's the first thing that you see when you walk into your bathroom? It's your mirror. And the face staring back at me in that mirror was a face that I did not recognize. And Todd was right there in the bathroom with me. And I lost it, and I began screaming at him because of the way my face looked. And at that point, he picked me up, and he threw me into the shower enclosure. And this time when it came to, he was banging my head against the back wall and my back against the edge of the bathtub. He knew I had bad kidneys. He was trying to kill me. So at this point, I knew that fighting with a man who was much larger than me was not something I could do physically. So I began apologizing to him. I began telling him, yes, it's all my fault and I'm sorry. And I said, and look at you, you're covered in blood. Now, Todd was not bleeding. It was my blood that had splattered all over him. So I said, you stay in the bathroom and clean up. And I'll go use the kitchen sink to clean up. And I'll clean up by the door where I got all my blood. I'm trying to appease him at this point. Because I am determined to try and get out of the apartment.
Sure. And you knew that was probably your best bet.
Oh, yeah.
In getting out.
Yeah. I knew I could not overpower him, but if I could talk him into relaxing for a moment, letting me be more than an inch away from him, because he was just... And so as soon as I walked out of the bathroom, I didn't go to the kitchen. I ran to the front door, and of course he saw that. Ugh. And he came after me, and I got the door open again. And this time he didn't slam it shut because I had hold of that screen door and I wouldn't let go. And he put his hands around my throat, and he said, if you utter one word, I will snap your neck. And you know I can do it. Because Todd had told me a story about a litter of puppies. His stepdad had a prized hunting dog that got impregnated by Todd's mutt dog. And so Todd's stepdad made him snap the necks of all the puppies that were delivered from that ruined litter.
He was made to do that.
Yes, they by told his him stepfather.
He had to do that. Mm-hmm. And is the stepfather also the pharmacist?
No.
No, that was his actual father.
Yeah, his actual father was the pharmacist. So I knew he would do it. So I just stood there at the door and I began praying. And I began asking God, is this where my life ends? And if so, I need to make amends for some things right here and now. And I began praying for my life. And I heard my next door neighbor's door open. Mm. I thought David got my text. And David came out his front door, but instead of turning left towards my unit, he turned right. And I'm thinking, what are you doing, David? Surely you got my text. You've heard me screaming over here. Let's face it, apartment walls aren't thick, folks.
Yeah, right.
But then I thought, okay, I know David sometimes carries a gun. Maybe he left his gun in his car, and David's going out to get his gun before he comes to my apartment door. So I hear David's footsteps coming back, and my heart's going, yes, I'm going to be saved. But David turns into his apartment instead. And at that point, my heart totally sank, and I thought, okay, God, this is it. Oh. I'm not going to see my parents. I'm not going to see my kids or my grandkids. I'm done for. Until I heard another set of footsteps. Dark clothing and a shiny badge appeared before my door. And as soon as I saw it, I did not care at that point if that officer pulled his weapon and fired it through me. But I was getting out of that apartment away from that monster. Because when he saw the officer, of course, he let go of around my neck.
He was probably trying to plead innocence at that point.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I didn't do anything.
So I bolted out the door. The officer took one look at my face, the blood streaming down of it. And he did pull his weapon at that point, and he ordered Todd Brinson to his knees, and he was arrested and taken to jail that night.
Wow.
I posted pictures of what I looked like on Facebook, and one of my good friends said, is this the same Todd J. Brinson whose father, Jack Brinson of Carmel, Indiana, blah, blah, blah? And I went, how'd you find that out? She said, I Googled his name. Do you know, in the entire time I knew this man, while we lived together, before I allowed him into the life of my family and my grandchildren, I never once Googled his name. I took everything he told me at face value. His family never told me anything different. Come to find out, background checks were done on me to make sure I was a suitable victim. Yeah.
Bye, Todd.
His father.
His father.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow.
When you say suitable victim, you literally mean they picked you out to be with Todd because they believed that you would be weak enough to not fight him back, or because of some other reason?
I don't know if necessarily weak enough to not fight him back. I don't think that was their thought. I think their thought was, I could change him. And you know what? Nobody can change anybody else, regardless of how much influence you have on them. It has to be their choice. And there were times during that year that Todd and I were living together that I think he wanted to change. But there were too many evil demons, because the truth of the matter on Todd's first incarceration was not that he beat up his wife's uncle. He beat up his wife. Todd was manufacturing methamphetamine, and he was selling it. And he was not happy that wife was giving it away for free. And he told wife to stop, and wife did not. Wife was inside of uncle's trailer when this incident happened, but it was not the uncle who was beaten. It was the wife. She was lifelined from Washington, Indiana, to Methodist Hospital. Her jaw and her skull had to be reconstructed. Todd was only given 12 years for that. He served 5 years and 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And then within 1 year and 3 days of release, he turned around and beat the next woman he swore that he loved. Once I Googled his name and read the horrific details of his first crime against his wife, that during their 4 years together, every time she got pregnant, he'd beat her till she miscarried. Yeah. But I didn't know any of this until after he beat me. So we went to court. I was advised by the prosecutor to accept the plea agreement. He was charged with 4 felonies: criminal confinement, strangulation, aggravated battery, and battery. They said he would plead to strangulation. He would get 2 years. I knew he had backup time from the prior sentence, I thought was 5 years backup, so I agreed to the plea agreement. I waited until he was in DOC custody for 6 months before I contacted the Daviess County prosecutor to violate him on that probation. That was a separate trial. His father said that the only reason his ex-wife was lifelined out of that county was because their podunk town didn't have any good neurosurgeons.
That's why.
That's why.
Not because he beat her.
Not because his son beat the woman within inches of her life. His son had suffered enough. His son had spent enough time behind bars.
It sounds like a lot of enabling by the family.
Very much so. Sadly, very, very much so. And perhaps they were in fear of Todd. One never knows.
Have you talked to the family since?
Oh, no. The only time I have seen them since, of course, at each court hearing, they were present. And, you know, after Todd got more time, that backup time, that got him another 2 years instead of 5. So he was released in total for everything. He went to jail in September of 2011, and he was released in September of 2013. And it took him less than 60 days to contact me, even though there was a criminal no-contact order and a civil no-contact order. And the day before Veterans Day, he phoned me on a Sunday evening. I knew who was calling, and I did not answer. I let it go to voicemail. And then he followed it up with a text, telling me that if I don't agree to his demands, that he's going to hire an attorney to come after me. Because, ladies and gentlemen, he wanted his valuable Beanie Baby collection back. Yep, that's a good enough reason to violate a no-contact order.
Remember when everybody thought those would be so much money?
Oh, yeah, they thought they would be, and that's what it was. He thought these things were worth thousands of dollars. We got them at garage sales for a nickel. You're not going to get $100,000 for them. And guess what? I donated all of those, as well as all of the stuffed animals that he won out of those claw machines that he won for my grandkids. All of those were donated to the Julian Center.
Nice.
Those children need those stuffed animals. He didn't.
Yeah.
So he violated the no contact order. So I violated him and I sent him back to prison for another year.
Because he violated
the no contact order. Yeah. And then in July of 2014, I get an email from him. Yeah.
So he was out of prison.
He had only been out maybe 14 days.
And he emailed you again.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what when he's getting out of prison every time,
oh,
right?
Yes, because it was called the Savin Alert System. And literally, I am notified anytime, because I was his victim, anytime he was moved from one facility to the next, anytime he was taken to a hospital or any facility for an appointment, I got text messages. And then as his release date came up, those became more and closer together. You know, first it was 90 days, here's his release, 60 days, 30 days. And those text messages always came at 3 a.m, always.
It's a great system, but
3 in the morning. 3 in the morning. Yeah. So, yeah, he had violated yet again, and I took him back to court.
Again? Third
again.
Time?
Yeah.
Did he serve again?
Well, that's where the story gets crazy, because that's where Misty and Keith come in. And it was in September of 2014 that I was contacted by a good friend of mine, John Gorman, who is part of a group called True Freedom Ministries, and he was volunteering for a program called Bridges to Life inside of Indiana prisons. And he said, we need you to come share your story. We need you. He said, this program is impactful, Sarah. He said, it helps the offender see crime from the victim's eyes. And he said, you're perfect. But when he told me which facility, I said, no way am I setting foot in there, because it was the facility where my offender had been housed during his incarceration. He was no longer there, but...
people probably knew him or knew of him.
Exactly. And so I wasn't too comfortable, but I was praying on it because my faith was very important to me. And all my scriptures were let go and let God and forgive. And I argued with God a lot that month. A whole lot. And so I walked into IREF on September 18th of 2014, exactly 3 years after that family dinner that went so well, just 3 days before he tried to kill me. And I walked into IREF and I shared my story for the first time. And it was not easy. I sat in a chair. I shook like a leaf. And I stared at my feet most of the time. And then the offenders get a chance to ask questions of the speaker afterwards.
That has to be a lot.
It was overwhelming.
Yes.
Especially when the first one said, ma'am, I just have to ask, why did you stay in that abusive relationship for so long? And I said, well, you know, Todd and I, he only hit me that one night and I sent him to prison. And he said, no, ma'am, I was referring to the 25 years of your marriage that you talked about. It was at that point I realized that my marriage was not only dysfunctional, there was some abuse both ways. It was bad. It was not what marriage was supposed to be. And that's what I was so determined to change with Todd. And the thing was, 1 week before he beat me, in my Bible study group, the ladies said to me, we see the love between the two of you at church every Sunday. If this is bothering you so much to be living with this man outside of marriage, Sarah, why don't you two just go ahead and get married? And my response to them was, because there's something that's just not quite right and I can't put my finger on it. So part of my story is the night of September 21st, 2011, God put my finger on it. God let me know that night. This man was not my knight in shining armor. He was not my prince charming. He was an animal. And he seeked out a woman with low self-esteem who enjoyed being pumped up with all of that happy talk. And he knew exactly what he was doing. I firmly believe it.
If he didn't know it, like face value, he definitely, there was something internal inside of him that connected it.
Yes. For had him. To have. Had to have. So I shared my story and I walked out of the prison, and 11 days later I walked into the courtroom and the prosecutor said, you ready to go to trial? And I said, no, doing a plea agreement. I thought she was going to fall out of her chair. She said, what? I said, I have to let it go. I said, so here's the plea agreement. Because Todd claimed his computer emailed me. He didn't. We all know computers do that all the time on their own.
My computer's been emailing people as we've been sitting here
touching nothing. Yes, yes. So that was his story. So I said he has to remove all of our electronic contacts because we had set up email accounts so that if one of us forgot the password, it would send the link to the other's email account. I said, so he has to remove all of those links. I said, I did that the minute he went to jail. I said, and he has to remove my contact information from all computers, cell phones, everything. He has to return every letter that I wrote to him in prison because that man could recite those letters to me. Yeah, it was sick. The prosecutor said, you want the letters? I said, no, I just want them destroyed. I just don't want them in his hands anymore. And I said, if he does these things and I have no contact from him for 60 days, I will drop this violation. But if he violates ever again, he better know we will be right back here into this courtroom. He returned those letters. They were burned, shredded, I don't know what. He obviously removed me from all electronic devices because as of September 29th of 2014, I've never laid eyes on Todd J. Brinson. That was the last time in court that day.
That's amazing. It's freeing.
It was. It was very freeing. And that's what I had to do. That was the only way to make it end.
And he listened.
He did, because I never heard from him again, ever.
But we do know where he is.
Oh, yeah. We know where he is. No one will be hearing from me again, because I found out in March of 2017 from his cousin that Todd had died. He didn't know the exact date, but I was able to obtain that information. And he died almost exactly 2 years to the day from when he was released from prison for the last time for the offenses against me. He died on July 9th of 2016, I've been told.
3 years from today.
Wow. Didn't even realize that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Whoa.
That's a higher power.
Yeah, it is.
And we don't know how he died?
Believe it was a drug overdose. Whether it was intentional or not, don't know. But that's what I've heard.
Thank you for sharing your story. You're very good at it.
And you're so brave. That's the whole time, that's all I could think about. Your bravery.
You know, it has been a work in process, you know, and it has been through the Bridges to Life program that I have grown, and I have learned that I am not a victim. I am a survivor, and that's what's most important, and that's what I share, is there is life beyond these things. I made mistakes, too. I accept responsibility and accountability for every wrong thing I've done. I have to. That's all I ask of the inmates in the program. Let this program work you, because it will change your life. Mm. And I've watched it. I've watched it happen.
That has to be a good feeling to see that.
Oh, it is so rewarding. You know, it's a 14-week session, and they come in that first week with their arms crossed and looking on their face, and then I start sharing my story, and boy, those defenses come down because they realize a lot of them have a lot in common with me that they never could have imagined from that lady who walked in the door. Mm-hmm. And then as we work through each week, and we work through the questions, and they're tough questions. They make you look deep inside of yourself. And as you work through it, you become a different person. And that is what has made me who I am today. Misty calls me her crazy volunteer. I'm in prison 3 nights a week. Yeah.
So do you, about the program, from day one until the end of the 14-week program, are you with them those 3 days a week? Or are there different people in there with them? Or?
Oh, no. I go to each facility myself. I go to the Plainfield Correctional Facility on Tuesday nights. I go to the Indianapolis Women's Prison on Wednesday nights. And the Pendleton Correctional Facility on Thursday nights.
What could they possibly have in common with you? They're offenders. How could they? You're a survivor.
Yes, but you know what, Joe? They're human beings just like me. Human beings who have made bad choices that got them in bad places. And part of my story is, if not for the grace of God, I could be sitting there in khakis right there with you. But I'm not. But I'm here to share with you that if you can turn your life around and give it to God, you'll see such an amazing transformation. And I do see it in that 14-week time period. I see it session after session. I've been doing this 5 years.
I have two topics that I wanted to ask you. First and foremost, advice for anybody who's going into a relationship or paying attention. I mean, gosh, people go into relationships all the time. You're never going to know until it's too late.
Yeah.
What do you have for women who...
Or men,
who might be in an abusive relationship, or what can people do?
Tell people, because that's one of the first thing that an abuser does is they isolate you. They do not want you around others. And that was one of the things I noticed about Todd. He didn't want me off at Bible study by myself with these ladies. That bothered him. Things like that bothered him. So they want to isolate you. They don't want you to feel comfortable talking to other people about your problems. When you see that control, when you see that, oh, they don't want you out of their sight, no, ladies or gentlemen, that is not love. That is control and manipulation. And all that is going to lead to is nothing but harm. I guarantee it. I've seen it time after time in more relationships than I care to imagine.
So control, manipulation, isolation.
Yes.
Three big red flags.
Yes.
Is there anything else that sticks out?
Just do your homework on them. Don't take it for face value, you know? And even if their family doesn't step up and say, hey, maybe he isn't 100% what he's led you to believe, just don't take everybody at face value. I guess I've just learned it's really hard for me to trust because of this, because I opened myself up and I got hurt.
The other topic section I wanted to ask is, do you think that the state does enough, what Bridges to Life does, the hope that they bring, does there need to be more, and where is that for the state, county, city, wherever these jails are? What can be done, in your opinion, to make it better?
It's a great program. What we need are more volunteers willing to go in these facilities. We're currently in 7 Indiana facilities. There are 17 in the state, and I'm just talking prisons. That's not county jails or juveniles, that type of stuff that, you know, there's a lot of facilities out there that would love to have this program. And that's what I hear when I tell people about it. They have family members, say, at Wabash or at, you know, one of the other facilities. And are you there? No, not yet. But if we can get more volunteers, we can get the program into more of these facilities.
Do all the volunteers have a story like you or Misty's story?
No, not necessarily. A lot of these people are just, they're led to volunteer for this because they too see the difference it makes in people's lives. It's benefiting to them too as well, because they feel like, I mean, it's a lot of these folks are very spiritually based people, and it's in the Bible that you're supposed to visit those in prison. And a lot of these people are drawn to it for that factor, but then once they get in, they're like me, and they're like, oh, I can't get enough of this stuff. Mm. It's just, I don't know. The transformation that you see in these people, and the ones who come back as encouragers, because once they've graduated the program, then they can return and be an encourager. And that helps the other offenders see that, okay, this is somebody that, you know, lives with me every day, and they're up here talking about their personal business, and they're okay with it. Because that's not an easy thing to do inside of an Indiana institution.
Let's be honest here. Just because someone's in prison doesn't mean they're any more broken than anyone outside of prison.
Oh, no. No, definitely. And believe me, we are all broken at some point. Each and every one of us. Yeah.
Hands up. Yes. This is an unbelievable podcast. Absolutely. You're an incredible woman. And just absolutely a true honor that you're here to share it with us.
Thank you, Joe.
I've had a lot of fun. I do have another question.
Yeah, yeah. Go, okay. Carrie. Yeah.
Right. So from that point where he was in jail and you were no longer with him and all this, your abuse happened, did you do anything for yourself to, like, in your Bible studies, or were you involved in any type of therapy?
Oh, gosh, or? Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Most amazing thing, and you know, God was instrumental in every part of my life. I know he has been, but it's just been more and more proven to me through these different things that have happened through this, you know, that I've been asked, where was your God that night you were getting beaten? My God was right there next to me, taking each and every punch with me. My God was crying right along with me. My God knew that he gave me free will, and I made a choice to allow a person into my life that I did not fully check into. Am I 100% at fault? No, but I have to accept some responsibility and accountability for what happened.
When you say let go as well, we've talked about that earlier, you know, how much of that is forgiveness?
Oh, yeah.
Because Keith and Misty, we talk about that a lot with her.
Yes.
But how much of this is you forgiving Todd?
Yes, and I've had to, you know, because, and the way I refer to it is, if you don't forgive that person, it's like letting them rent space in your head for free. Have an eviction ceremony and get them out. You have to. And it took a long time for me to do that with Todd. And did I ever have a face-to-face like Keith and Misty? No. But God knows that I turned it over to him that day when I did not send him to jail for that last violation. I put it in God's hands completely that day and said, God, if it's your will, I'll never hear from this man again. And I never did.
That's amazing.
And to think that he would contact you, and what would make him stop other than maybe God's will? And it's crazy because we talk about that with Misty too and Keith, mm-hmm. you know, there's many moments in God's will. I mean, the moment that man turned right instead of left or vice versa,
yes.
to turn and see Misty uh-huh. on the ground to save her.
Yes.
And he was a vet who knew medic.
Oh, yeah.
It was insane. Like that, those kind of stuff, mm-hmm. like we talk about. And unless you live it, and unless there are moments where you see it and feel it yourself, you'll never understand what God's will and love really means.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Just crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So hopefully people listening will understand or maybe get a feel. And maybe if they're lost, they can go out and reach out and get some help.
Yes. I hope they do.
Yeah. That's why we're doing. That's why I'm here. Because I hope that someone hears this and changes.
Yes.
Even if it is a possible future offender who maybe yeah. hears this and says, I need some help.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. I could not hold it.
We can cut that, sweetie.
That's why I did this, so there was a long pause for you.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
If anybody listening is interested in volunteering for Bridges to Life, go to bridgestolife.org. Misty's contact information is there on the site. I'd love to welcome more volunteers, and you'll get to even hear more of my story.
Carrie, is there anything you'd like to say? How was your first Infamous Indie podcast?
Good.
Yeah. Thanks for joining me, because
yeah,
I think it's
of course.
You don't have a choice. Well, everybody, as always, I think you should say it this time, Sarah, because I say it every time at the end of the podcast. It's just simple. Stay safe. And I'd love for you to do it for me. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Stay safe, Indianapolis.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Cool. Thank you.
All right, everybody, as I mean, that was a tearjerker for sure. Carrie and I was tearing up, but more importantly, just thank you to Sarah for sharing her story, and everything that she had to say came from the heart. And if you guys were in front of her, there's actually a video, and I'm going to start doing this now. So I'm going to give you an example of maybe a video of Sarah, and show you what was going on while our interview was going on. And there's like I took it with my phone while I was interviewing her, so with Carrie. So you guys can check that out. I'll be posting that throughout the week. It's going to be a lot of interesting stuff coming up with the Dillinger stuff. Don't forget about that. Follow me on Instagram and on Facebook, as well as the Infamous Indie Podcast. And always go to the infamousindie.com webpage to contact me or get any of the other episodes if you don't have a player. Thanks again, all. And it's been a successful couple weeks. And I love my stepdad, Les. He was an amazing, amazing man. And thanks for sticking around. He was one of the most important men in my life by far. And he took care of my mom and my sisters for a long time. 17 years, my mom and him were together. So just hug your loved ones, everybody. And as I always say at the end of an episode, stay safe.